B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, January 16th, 2018. And it's a short week. Many people had Monday off for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. And it just brings to light how racism is a continuing blight here in the United States. And so hard to see 50 years after Dr. King was assassinated that we have a resurgent of race-based hate stoked by the resident of the Oval Office. It is astounding. Well, on Sunday, Chelsea Manning, the whistleblower whose sentence was commuted by President Obama before he left office, announced that she is going to run for the U.S. Senate seat in Maryland, currently held by Ben Cardin. And what's interesting is there have been little blurbs, you know, one-inch articles, Chelsea Manning going to run for the Senate, but very little coverage of this in any significant way in the corporate media. And I watched the LGBTQ icon Rachel Maddow from beginning to end her program last night, and she was so deeply embedded in the Russiagate scandal that she didn't find any time to share with her listeners that an icon of the trans movement, an icon of progressive anti-war politics, an icon of many movements, has made a significant step. Now, you can, you know, use the calculation that, gosh, you know, Chelsea Manning has no political experience, no political base. She won't be able to raise millions of dollars to challenge this powerful, white, male, straight, old incumbent. But that's not the point. And Glenn Greenwald wrote a great piece that's published at The Intercept. It was up yesterday, noting that Manning is an icon of LGBTQ equality, transgender rights, and that, he says, at least matches, if not surpasses, her role as a whistleblower. And he goes on to say that she has used her perch to promote protections for whistleblowers, that her activism and political experience is greater than, well, Greenwald says, Al Franken when he first came to the Senate. And if elected, Manning would become the first transgender woman ever, youngest woman ever, to serve in the United States Senate. And he correctly labels Ben Cardin, the 74-year-old white straight man who is seeking his third 6-year Senate term. And not only is he a man with little accomplishment, those things he has taken on most recently reflect the agenda of the State of Israel, its AIPAC supporters in the United States, and he has been active in trying to squelch those of us who want to use our First Amendment rights to promote boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the State of Israel. And he authored a bill to make it a felony to support BDS. It so far has not passed. But when Chelsea Manning announced, general silence from the mainstream media, but the centrist establishment Democrats wasted no time, and Neera Tanden, from her perch at the Center for American Progress, major apologist for Hillary Clinton and her loss, one of the people who initiated the Russiagate narrative as the way to explain the stunning loss to Trump. Here's a tweet. Senator Cardin authored and released a 200-page masterpiece on Russian influence in Western elections. Suddenly, he has a primary from Kremlin stooge Assange's WikiLeaks primary source Chelsea Manning. Now, let me just read that sentence again, because it is so loaded. Suddenly, he has a primary from Kremlin stooge Assange's WikiLeaks primary source Chelsea Manning. Now, there's no indication that Julian Assange ever had any direct contact with Chelsea Manning when, as Bradley Manning, he coughed up all kinds of secret documents to WikiLeaks. And to smear Chelsea Manning as somehow tied to Russia is pure bullshit. The tweet ends, "The Kremlin plays the extreme left to swing elections. Remember that." This is really insidious. And Greenwald got some pushback for only citing Neera Tanden's tweet. And he updated the article today after noting that the Center for American Progress mostly does not disclose its donors except for corporate ones. They list the Embassy of the United Arab Emirates as a donor in the 500,000 to a million range, and also the Walton Family Foundation. But after the pushback, Greenwald went back to Twitter, found this from Zach Patkanis. "Chelsea Manning could have leaked the info anywhere. She went to an arm of Russian intelligence, bent of supplanting liberal democracy worldwide with right-wing authoritarianism. She and all unapologetic Russian assets, witting and unwitting, don't belong in the Senate." And here's a Molly McHugh. "A little too convenient that Chelsea Manning will primary Senator Cardin, one of the most active senators on foreign policy, and leader in making policy legislation to respond to Russian aggression for the Maryland Senate. Guess that's what Dem Tea Party is going to look like, Snowden Party." Molly McHugh later tweeted, "I know there are a lot of people who still think of Manning as a whistleblower, but the agent of a foreign power coerced this individual, leveraging their emotional distress into breaking their oath to the country and disclosing classified secrets, period." Nobody coerced Chelsea Manning, Bradley Manning. That is pure fiction. And at this stage, before, you know, she's even got a website up or held her first fundraiser, Chelsea Manning is being attacked as the agent of the tool of the agent of a foreign power. And this aligns the Democratic establishment with McCarthyism, red baiting, and the smear tactics that epitomized the 1950s, and we thought we had recovered. And here's a tweet liked by Joy Reid, the diva at MSNBC. Oh, it's just a repeat of the Neera Tanden tweet that I just read you a moment ago. And Greenwald ends his article by saying, just to underscore the point again, the issue is totally ancillary to the primary point of my article, which is about how centrist Democrats exploit identity politics when it suits them, but then feel free to keep old white straight men in power at the expense of marginalized minority candidates such as Manning. And Norman Solomon takes a bit of a different angle, writing at Consortium News today. And by the way, Norman also tweeted the news, or I got it on Facebook, that CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling, the African-American who initially complained about disparity in treatment because of his race, and then was accused of making phone calls to James Risen when he was at the New York Times, he was convicted purely on circumstantial evidence. They never used the content of the phone calls, just the fact that they were made in order to convict him. At any rate, Solomon's piece takes the angle of Ben Cardin's role as the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and that report that was issued last week, which I touched on briefly but really offered nothing new. It was a rehash of a bunch of warmed-over allegations. And Cardin is at what Solomon calls the tip of the anti-Russia propaganda spear. After 3 decades in Congress, a dozen years in the Senate, he's an old hand at spinning. No one has worked harder to get political mileage out of Russiagate, says Solomon. And he continues, the expansion of NATO up to Russia's borders, the U.S. interference in dozens of countries' elections, including Russia, during the Clinton administration, Washington's support for repressive regimes in the past and present, such realities don't merit consideration or mention. Nor did facts like the U.S. role as the world's biggest arms merchant, or the aggressively deadly U.S. military interventions in the recent past and present, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya. The extreme hostility toward Russia that makes such an outcome more likely must be rejected. And Solomon closes by saying Ben Cardin is one of the loudest, most prominent voices for such hostility. He should be challenged. This week is going to be one of bluff and brinksmanship in Washington, because the legislators have once again laid a trap for themselves. The continuing resolution on the government spending plan that has been kicked down the road three times now, is it four? is due to expire at the end of this week. And after the fallout from the shithouse comment from Trump last week, he has declared that DACA, relief for the Dreamers, is dead. Now, I think this is just a negotiating posture from our Mercurial, number 45. But it is fair to say that it has hardened attitudes and made any kind of compromise or dialogue more difficult. And Trump and his allies are still trying to sow confusion about what he actually said and try to mislead people into believing he didn't say shithouse. I heard Rush Limbaugh. It's like he was on 18 OxyContin again, because he was tied up in contortions trying to explain this. Midwest Senator Joni Ernst was laughed at by members of a town hall when she addressed these matters. And the new head of Homeland Security, Kirsten What's-Her-Name, got a real chewing out from Senator Cory Booker when she appeared on Capitol Hill today, but she refused to acknowledge. And she said, "I don't remember what he said. I can't say that he exactly said that. Blah, blah, blah." To his credit, Senator Lindsey Graham is not suffering from amnesia after the Trump comments last week, like his colleagues David Perdue of Georgia and Tom Cotton of Arkansas. And he took a little swipe at him. "Since the meeting, I don't remember things differently. I know what I heard, and I know what I said to the president." So he's essentially backing up Dick Durbin's characterization of the comments without explicitly quoting them. But this is a very dicey situation. It has been compounded, and the hostage situation of the so-called Dreamers remains an ugly blight on the American landscape. So Democrats are also ready to do business with Republicans to water down the Dodd-Frank law and to basically eliminate some of the rules for banks and limit them to the top 10 biggest banks in the country. And the support of wobbly Democrats who are in states that were carried by Trump is a real problem here. Because under current law, banks with assets of $50 billion or more are considered systemically important financial institutions governed by stricter rules. But this would raise the threshold by a factor of five to institutions with assets of $250 billion or more, and that's only 10 of the biggest banks in the country. Banks with assets of $50 to $100 billion would be immediately freed from requirements, and the institutions between $100 and $250 billion would no longer be subject to tougher rules after 18 months. Now, this is a recipe for disaster. The self-regulation of Wall Street and the banks is what led to the 2008 meltdown. And it is just unconscionable that Democrats like Tester of Montana, Heitkamp of North Dakota, Donnelly of Indiana, Warner of Virginia, along with seven of their colleagues, are co-sponsoring this bill, which almost ensures its passage. And get this, under the bill, firms with less than $10 billion in assets would be exempt from the Volcker Rule, which prohibits banks from making risky bets with federally guaranteed deposits. Now, that is actually an incentive for banks to remain small to avoid regulation. But they're not going to break themselves up, and I think we know that. And over at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Nick Mulvaney is running amok busy dismantling the limited regulations that have been developed since Dodd-Frank went into effect. And when you put all this together, it helps define the split in the Democratic Party. And the new DNC chair, Tom Perez, sounding like Trump when he tweeted about how hard health care reform is, he said, well, I knew it was a turnaround job, but I undeniably underestimated the depth of the turnaround job. We had to rebuild almost every facet of the organization, and equally importantly, we had to rebuild trust. But I don't think you have, Mr. Perez. And the idea that by purging Sanders supporters, embracing the work of the Unity Reform Committee with a wink and a nod, it's unlikely that it will be adopted in the form that came out of that commission. And the establishment people in the Democratic Party who routinely say, hey, Bernie Sanders doesn't belong here, he's not a Democrat, they covet his massive email list. The DNC has repeatedly demanded that Sanders turn it over and allow state and local candidates to use it. But I think Sanders is smart not to turn the list over. That would be a huge mistake. Well, there was a huge mistake in Hawaii. You all know about that by now. Saturday morning, somebody at emergency services put out an alert about an imminent missile attack on the Hawaiian Islands. And it's happened again, this time in Japan. On Tuesday, NHK, the public broadcaster in Japan, sent out a news alert that North Korea had launched a missile. Citizens should take shelter. Now, in Hawaii, it took them 38 minutes to retract this erroneous warning. In Japan, it only took 5 minutes, and there was almost an immediate apology from NHK. Now, in Japan, typically the CEO will resign after a big blunder like this, we'll see. But in Hawaii, it took 38 minutes, and it was 5 hours before the governor, David Ige, went public with an apology. Now, these things could be understandable, you know, human error. But we should have fail-safe systems, multiple, you know, clicks required, different people. And it shouldn't be possible for one person to send out a mistaken alert like this. And in the coverage on the Sunday morning talk shows that I routinely avoid, George Stephanopoulos interviewed Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, a Democrat. And she was asked by George Stephanopoulos if it was a mistake for the U.S. to take out Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. It was absolutely, said Gabbard. And amplifying the comment, columnist Caitlin Johnstone, who is the Australian who really understands the United States political scene better than most of us, said, well, what she wanted to say was, it was absolutely, you fucking idiot. At any rate, Tulsi Gabbard went on to explain why President Trump should sit down with no preconditions with Kim Jong-un, and that she understands that the reason Kim wants a nuclear weapon, wants the nuclear capability, wants to be in the nuke club, is because of, quote, our country's history of regime change wars has led countries like North Korea to develop and hold on to these nuclear weapons because they see it as their only deterrent against regime change. And this is what's important for Trump to recognize. It is critical that we end our policies of regime change wars to provide that credible guarantee that the United States is not going to go in and topple the North Korean regime so that these conversations can begin toward denuclearization. And then with the myopic approach and the jingoist mentality that is so common to the corporate media in this country, Stephanopoulos asked, just to be clear, you're saying that Kim Jong-un's nuclear arsenal is our fault? And this is the kind of black and white thinking that we're the good guys and everybody else is a bad guy that is at the heart of our misguided foreign adventures for far too long now. And Gabbard's response goes like this. What I'm saying is that Democrat and Republican administrations for decades, going back over 20 years, failed to recognize the seriousness of this threat, failed to remove it. And we know that North Korea has these nuclear weapons because they see how the United States, in Libya, guaranteed Gaddafi, "We're not going to go after you. You should get rid of your nuclear weapons." He did. Then we went and led an attack that toppled Gaddafi, launching Libya into chaos that we are still seeing the results of today. North Korea sees what we did in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, with those false reports of weapons of mass destruction. And now seeing in Iran how President Trump is decertifying a nuclear deal that prevents Iran from developing nuclear weapons, threatening the very existence and the agreement that was made. So yes, we've got to understand North Korea is holding on to these nuclear weapons because they think it's their only protection from the United States. Well said. Meanwhile, despite assurances that we're going to stop the war games with South Korea, at least while the talks continue with the North, we have seen that the Trump administration has beefed up U.S. military assets around the Korean Peninsula, adding stealth bombers, at least one extra aircraft carrier, and a new amphibious assault ship to the region. Somebody isn't getting the message. There's a lot of publicity out there for an insider look at the final year of the Obama foreign policy team, and it's called The Final Year, made by Greg Barker. And I have watched this film, and I was going to interview Greg Barker, but it was so disappointing. It is just a puffball, a little Valentine to John Kerry, to Ben Rhodes, Samantha Power, and to some extent lesser, Susan Rice and the president himself. And while we go inside the limos and the meetings, we hear Samantha Power say how she loses sleep over dead Syrian babies, there wasn't a bit of policy discussion or criticism that shed any light on the failed policies that the Obama team was using, particularly related to Syria, where they believed that they could take out the Islamic State and remove Bashar al-Assad at about the same time, with no plan for what would come next. It's pretty crazy. Steve Bannon has been issued a subpoena, not directly from the special counsel, but Bob Mueller went to a grand jury and got them to issue the subpoena. Now, it may be simply a negotiating tactic to soften up Bannon and get him to talk to Mueller's investigators. We're not sure about that at this point, but it is a ratcheting up of pressure on people with very close ties to Trump. Jared Kushner was warned to watch out for Wendy Dung Murdoch, the ex-wife of Sir Keith Rupert Murdoch, the head of the News Corp empire, recently sold 21st Century Fox to Disney for a pile of money. And what's interesting here is that the implication is that Wendy Dung Murdoch is some sort of a spy for China. Now, maybe she is. But this is really poison pen reporting from the Wall Street Journal, because that's where the story originates, that Kushner was warned about Murdoch's ex-wife. So I can't figure out what the real motivation is there, but it is curious. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And a big shout out and a thank you and an aloha mahalo to John Zweibel, who is our Kama Aina guy in Hawaii. And he just sent me a big check to help pay the bills here at peterbcollins.com, and I appreciate it. Also, want to mention Jason Ferguson, Janet Price, Joey Perillo, and Tim McKay. They kick in a few bucks every month to help the podcast, and I'd like you to join them. All you got to do is visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, click on it, pull it down. It takes you to the sign-up page if you click on Become a Subscriber, and there you've got some easy options. And by the way, if you use the Peter B. Collins app for iPhone and iPad, we are feverishly working to update it and to correct one of the flaws, which is that it doesn't play in the background, and it will pause when your device goes to sleep. So we're going to fix that, and we'll let you know when the new and improved PBC podcast app 2.0 is ready for you. Well, here's good news for Russia, Venezuela, and American environmentalists, because the price of crude oil on the world market has been climbing, and today it reached $70 a barrel. Now, I don't celebrate the increased profitability of extraction, refining, and consumer sales of oil-based products, but a higher price makes renewables competitive. It gets people to think about buying a hybrid instead of an SUV. So I consider that to be a positive development at this point. It comes from a deal between Russia and the Saudis to reduce production at the same time that the rebounding world economy is increasing demand. The president of Turkey is really pissed at Trump. Recep Tayyip Erdogan lashed out on Monday at the plan to continue supporting Kurdish militia fighters along Turkey's southern border. Now, we've been using and abusing the Kurds for several years now as proxy fighters in Syria and Iraq, and that's going to continue. The plan is to train up and fund a border force that could grow to 30,000. And Erdogan, of course, is all hopped up about this. He said that a nominal ally, the U.S., has now acknowledged that it's established a terror army along our borders. Our duty in return is to nip this terror army in the bud. My San Francisco Chronicle, with the estimable Bob Agelko, published a story today. And it's a little bit complicated here, but you may know that James Risen left the New York Times and is now writing for The Intercept. And a couple of weeks ago, he wrote a lengthy piece about how the New York Times blocked his publication of stories that exposed the illegal domestic wiretapping back in 2004. It was finally published in 2005. And during that time, there was a lot of pressure put on the Times not to publish it. And part of that came from a Democrat, Jane Harman, a congresswoman from Los Angeles, senior Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. And she reached out to the New York Times and said, oh, don't publish this. Now, Agelko does a good job of recapping it, and I've linked to his article in the show file for today's podcast. But he either didn't have room or forgot to mention the deep irony that pro-wiretapping, pro-surveillance, Jane Harman, was the subject of intercepts of her own secret conversations with Israeli agents. And she was trying to make a deal to get the Israelis to promote Jane Harman as candidate for chair of the Intelligence Committee when Nancy Pelosi became speaker. Now, this was not exposed until 2009. But Jane Harman was bitten by the monster that she had been protecting. And even today, she doesn't appear to see the irony in that picture. I've never been to Perris, California. It's spelled P-E-R-R-I-S. But I know too much about this city in Riverside County because I have investigated cases of wrongful conviction coming from Perris. And it's a mess. I'll just leave it at that. And I don't mean to demonize an entire community over its history, but Perris is back in the news as the scene of the home of Louisa Turpin and David Turpin and their 13 children, ranging from the age of 2 to 29, who appear to be imprisoned in the family home. Now, they had registration to homeschool the kids, but they appeared to lock them down in almost a military style. And one of the kids escaped, a teenager. The police came, and the parents are now being held $9 million bail each. I wasn't present at the date between a woman who calls herself Grace and Netflix TV star Aziz Ansari. And I don't know what happened between them. But Grace published a 3,000-word tell-all at the so-called feminist website Babe, and it has certainly gotten a lot of attention over the last few days. What I'm pleased to see is that since there wasn't an allegation that he coerced her, that he sexually assaulted her. There was a consensual hookup that appeared to lack chemistry. And it's fair to say that based on her account, we don't have his side of the story, really. That things didn't go well on this date. He read the situation that here's a horny girl who wants to get it on with me. And there's been some really powerful commentary. I'll link to it in the show file. Barry Weiss, a woman who is on the editorial staff of the New York Times, wrote a powerful piece saying that Grace is somebody who has described herself as a victim, and that the real problem was that Ansari was not able to read her mind. And she goes on to say, if you're hanging out naked with a man, it's safe to assume he's going to try to have sex with you. And the complainant had whined that they had wine and she prefers white, but he just opened a red one. And Weiss says, if the inability to choose a Pinot Noir over a Pinot Grigio offends you, you can leave right then and there. If you don't like the way your date hustles through paying the check, you can say, I've had a lovely evening, I'm going home now. If you go home with him and discover he's a terrible kisser, say, I'm out. If you start to hook up and don't like the way he smells or the way he talks, end it. And so she goes on to say that there's a useful term for what Grace experienced on her night with Ansari. It's called bad sex, and it sucks. Also, Ashley Banfield on the Headline News channel made some equivalent comments. And in an op-ed at The Guardian, Jill Filipovich notes that Babe did not interview Ansari before publishing the piece, barely gave him time, just 5 hours to respond to it, and that is a violation of the fundamental rules of journalism. So I hope we're going to see some rational approach. I believe that we should be outing sexual predators, sexual criminals, but not people who are thinking in the groin in the moment. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide, and we serve it up on YouTube every day. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to until we meet again, happy trails to you.